In the summer of 1974, I heard one of the greatest lectures on trial practice I've ever heard anywhere. The lecture was delivered from the top of a mountain overlooking Boulder, Colorado, during the course of the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. The speaker, Professor Irving Younger, his subject, The Art of Cross-Examination. Irv Younger is an outstanding trial lawyer. He's a former district attorney in New York. He served as a state court trial judge. He was on the faculty at New York University School of Law. And today he holds the Samuel S. Liebowitz professorship in trial practice at Cornell University. Irv expends unbelievable amounts of time and energy trying to make better trial lawyers out of all of us. This section of litigation is very proud, very happy to be able to present to you Professor Irving Younger on the art of cross-examination.
Ladies and gentlemen, your planning committee was so rash as to give me an entire morning to talk about cross-examination. But it's not enough. Cross-examination is so complicated, there's so much to say, that we can't possibly do the subject justice in just a morning. I'm going to be talking then about only one kind of cross-examination. Now let me take a moment to mention a couple of the kinds of cross-examinations I will not be discussing. There will be occasions when a trial lawyer wants to cross-examine a witness so as to persuade the jury that the witness is worth believing. I'm not talking about that kind of cross-examination. There will be occasions when a trial lawyer wants to cross-examine a witness so as to convey to the jury some impression of his, the cross-examiner's, theory of the case. I'm not talking about that kind of cross-examination. The kind of cross-examination I will be talking about is the one that's probably most commonly encountered in the courtroom and probably the most difficult to do. It's what I call destructive cross-examination. Cross-examination whose purpose is to persuade the jury that the witness is not worth believing. You might also call it impeaching the witness or discrediting the witness. That's all we'll be discussing this morning. And because once the frenzy strikes me, I'm a little bit difficult to follow, let me give you a sort of roadmap, a ground plan of what we will be discussing. We're going to be talking about two big topics. The first topic, which will carry us through roughly the coffee break, is the technology of this kind of cross-examination. The what to do. The doctrinal foundation of destructive cross-examination. And after coffee break, we will talk about the art of cross-examination. Not what to do, but how to do it. We begin with the technology. The doctrinal foundation of destructive cross-examination. Here, we must look at the law of evidence. Now, all of you have whirling about in your minds a million or so miscellaneous rules, customs, techniques, tricks of the trade, etc., etc., which collectively add up to the law of evidence. A major part of that vast miscellany deals with cross-examination. But many of us, simply because we're so wrapped up in the hurly-burly of practice, do not have the occasion to put it all together in some useful and coherent fashion. That's what I propose to do for you first thing this morning. I'm going to take that part of the law of evidence which deals with cross-examination, which supplies its doctrinal foundation, and attempt to put it together so as to form a coherent pattern, something that you can carry in your consciousness and use on a split second's notice, which is, of course, the way in which you usually have to use it in a courtroom. Then we'll have a coffee break. And after the coffee break, we'll talk about the art of cross-examination. So let's go to work. What is the doctrinal foundation of this kind of cross-examination? What does the law of evidence permit you to do? What does it forbid you to do when you stand up to conduct a destructive cross-examination of a witness, the process of impeaching or discrediting a witness? Now, having wasted the flower of my youth on this subject, ladies and gentlemen, I have one piece of wisdom for you. So far as I have been able to determine, and I confess right at the start, you will find this in no book and in no case, but I do believe it to be true. So far as I have been able to determine, all of these miscellaneous rules dealing with cross-examination coalesce into 9 categories or pigeonholes of impeachment or discrediting. Now, not every jurisdiction permits all 9. And as a matter of tactics, you will rarely want to use all 9. But these nine are exhaustive. They represent the universe of possible impeachment. And if you keep these nine pigeonholes in mind, all of these miscellaneous rules, it seems to me, will fall into place. But nine's kind of a lot. Most of us are getting old. We have difficulty remembering one or two things, let alone nine things. Is there anything I can do to help you to remember the nine? Yes, I have organized them in a way that I think you will find to be memorable. Here's how. Nine, remember, is the total. We've got a first group of four. And then a second group of four. And finally, all by itself, the ninth. And we're just going to go through them and see what they add up to. And I tell you again, I'm just going to be reminding you of things that you already know. The most that I can hope to accomplish is suggest a more useful way of looking at these rules. Now, what are the first four modes of impeachment? It's astonishing. Every one of you, as a trial lawyer, and by the way, footnote, I speak to you as one trial lawyer to another, right? We mince no words, we call things by their right name. If there are any judges in the room, which I doubt, but if there are any judges, they are here by virtue of having once been trial lawyers, maybe, right? So, we do not stand on ceremony, we do not respect personalities here. We're talking about the kind of work that we do in the courtrooms every day. Now, what about these first four I began to say? Every one of you uses them every single time you're in court. Yet I bet you've never thought of them this way. Now, what are they? Backtrack a little bit. Come with me out to left field, but slowly we'll return to home plate. Go back to law school. You took a course in evidence. You didn't know which end was up. Huh? What the hell was that guy talking about? You didn't know, right? You've learned a little bit as a result of the practice since. But one thing you may recall is competence, right? The eligibility of a human being to take the witness stand. Now, what does it take for a human being to be eligible to take the witness stand today? We put aside incompetence by reason of status. The dead man statute, spousal incompetence, the incompetence of a judge or a juror to testify in that very trial. We talk about the great run of proposed witnesses, the ordinary person. What is it that must be present before the ordinary person is eligible to take the witness stand, is competent to be a witness? And if you don't remember, let me remind you. Four elements must be present. Now, what are they? The four elements of competence. Well, what's the first thing that happens when you call someone to the stand? Think back to last week or ahead to next week. You're in your home courtroom. The judge says, call your next witness. You don't have a next witness, right? The doctor hasn't arrived yet. What do? You know what to do. You turn around to the audience and you just say, you, take the stand. Doesn't matter who it is. Waste a lot of time. Meanwhile, maybe the doctor will arrive. So we say, you, take the stand. Is he eligible to be a witness? Not yet. First, he's got to do what? What's the first requirement of competence? What? Tell me. Yeah, take the oath, or some substitute for the oath, right? I swear to tell the truth, or I affirm to tell the truth, or I promise to tell the truth, or as one grandfather to another, Your Honor, I will tell the truth. Something like that, huh? And what happens if he says, no, I won't take the oath, or some substitute for the oath? He's not competent. He may go to jail for contempt, but he may not take the stand and testify. So we've got the first requirement of competence. Now what's the second? He takes the oath. Now what? What'd you see, huh? Or what'd you hear? Or what'd you smell? Or what'd you touch? Or what did you taste? The witness must have perceived, that is to say, obtained sense data through one or more of his five senses, must have perceived something having to do with the transaction which forms the subject matter of the lawsuit. So we've got the second requirement, perception, right? Oath, perception. So I call him to the stand. He takes the oath, no problem. Now we say, sir, did you see the accident? No, I did not. Where were you? I was in Europe. What happens now? Well, the judge says, thank you for your assistance, sir, but you may go home. You are incompetent. You perceived nothing. Now, the third requirement of competence. We've got to get from time past, when the transaction occurred which formed the subject matter of this lawsuit, to time present. Now, in the courtroom. What's the word for that? Memory, recollection, remembrance, any such idea. To bridge the temporal gap. So the witness must remember something of what he perceived concerning the subject matter, the transaction which is the subject matter of this lawsuit. Take the oath. Yes, sir. Did you see the accident? Yes, sir. We've satisfied the first two requirements. What do you remember seeing? Nothing. Go home. You're incompetent. You have failed to satisfy the third requirement. And now the fourth. What? Well, we've got to get out of the witness's mind his memory of what he perceived. Got to get it across to the jury or the judge. And what's the one word which summarizes it? Communication. The witness must be able to communicate in some rational fashion what he remembers perceiving. Typically in the English language, a foreign language, if that's what's necessary. Write it out, if that's the way you have to do it. The international sign language, whatever, so long as it's a rational mode of communication. There you've got the four requirements of competence. The oath, perception, recollection, communication. But we're not finished with competence yet. Another couple of minutes before we get back to impeachment or cross-examination. Suppose a question is raised, ladies and gentlemen, as to the competence of a witness. Now, most of you have probably done it. You know with respect to which element? The first, taking the oath. I dare say every one of you has been involved in a trial in which a child has been called to the witness stand. An 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old. Well, what do you do? If the tactics are appropriate, you raise a question concerning the competence of the witness. Now, what do we mean? Mechanically, the child can raise his or her right hand and say, yes, I swear, of course. But we look a little bit more deeply than that. Is the witness of sufficient maturity to understand the nature and significance of the oath? And who decides that question? The judge, of course. Because competence is a question of law, which the judge must decide. And to stick with our example of the child, what will happen? Well, in the courts that I'm familiar with, the judge will now conduct a voir dire, usually in the robing room, perhaps out in open court, but almost always not in the presence of the jury, if there is a jury. And you know what the judge will do. He'll say, Sonny, how old are you? 8, sir. Do you go to Sunday school? Yes, sir. You know, what happens if you tell a lie, etc., etc. And the judge then decides whether this witness has sufficient maturity to understand the nature and significance of the oath. And that's an either-or proposition. The witness can knowingly take the oath or cannot. If the former, competent with respect to that first element. If the latter, incompetent with respect to that first element. But how about a question of competence with respect to the second, third, and fourth requirements? Perception, recollection, communication. It is very rare for a challenge to be raised to the competence of a witness on these grounds. Remember, it's for the judge to decide. We switch from the question of competence, which the judge decides, to a different question entirely. What question? Credibility, believability of the witness, which the jury decides, or the judge wearing his jury's hat, of course. The judge may hold that a reading of 5 on that thermometer with respect to recollection is enough to render the witness competent. But now the jury is perfectly free to conclude that a witness who only remembers 5 out of 100 should not be believed, that his testimony is not worth crediting, and the jury is perfectly free to reject that testimony in its entirety. The jury's not overruling the judge, of course not. Those are two different issues. That's why I do it on two different sides of the lecture. Here, competence for the judge to decide. Here, credibility for the jury to decide. And now do you see the first 4 categories of impeachment? Well, of course. You take those 4 elements of competence and you turn them around. And you use them destructively. I repeat, tactically you may not want to do it. We're working out a checklist of all the possibilities. And here you've got the first 4. Take the oath and turn it around. All right? Cross-examination. Sir, you just took an oath to tell the truth. Yes. When's the last time you went to church or synagogue? Right. Is that the kind of cross-examination I came all the way to this lovely city to tell you about? Well, yes and no. It's there because it's the first item on the checklist. But will you ever use such a question on cross-examination? Not if you're in your right mind. Why? It's greasy kid stuff. That's why. You did that when you were a youngster at the bar. Maybe you did that. But nowadays, you never would. It's embarrassing. If that's the only kind of question you have to ask on cross-examination, you won't ask it. As a matter of fact, the draftsman of the federal evidence rules included in the new federal evidence code, Rule 610. Remember what it is? You may not impeach a witness by asking questions about religious belief or practice. You just may not. This first pigeonhole is not available in the federal courts. It's available in most other courts, but not in the federal courts. Why did the draftsman of the federal rules exclude it in federal courts? Just because it's greasy kid stuff. You shouldn't do it, so they put it right in the rule. You can't do it. But we repeat, we're just developing a checklist. We're not talking now about how to do it or what tactically makes sense. We're talking about what's available, and there you have it. Now, what's the second pigeonhole of impeachment? What's the second requirement of competence? Perception, right? We know the judge is going to rule the witness competent if you raise the question at that stage, so we'll wait for cross-examination. And now we'll go at it, right? The witness has just testified on direct examination that he saw the automobile accident, and it took place in front of the cloisters in Fort Tryon Park in Upper Manhattan, right? Now, cross-examination. Mr. Witness, where were you when the accident occurred? I was at 32nd Street and 5th Avenue. Ha! What do you do now? Stop! Sit down! Will you stop? Why won't you stop? Because whether you're 25 or 65, it seems to be a matter of the way in which trial lawyers are constructed. They are congenitally incapable of shutting up. They're sitting down, stopping. Of course you should stop at that point. For those of you who don't know the geography of Manhattan, the witness has just told us he saw an accident at the northern tip of the island when he was standing at 5th Avenue and 32nd Street, 3 miles to the south. You should stop, of course, and argue in summation that the witness was 3 miles away. Of course he didn't see it. Instead, what will you do, every one of you? You will go on to the next question. Then how come you could see the accident if you were 3 miles away? And you know the answer you're going to get every time you ask that question? Well, I was on top of the Empire State Building with high-powered binoculars, and I saw it through the binoculars. Still, there it is. Second mode of impeachment. Now the third. What's the third requirement of competence? Come, come. We review. Note how cunningly we review. Tell me what implement. You're taking notes. Memory, right? So turn it around. This is a very useful one. You've all used it, though perhaps you may not have known exactly what, you know, the right label for what you were doing. Let's take an example from the criminal field. In my days in the U.S. Attorney's Office, conspiracy cases were really something. Right? Nowadays, I don't know, maybe it's beginning to change, but more or less nowadays, a conspiracy case is kind of a joke. It's a baby doctor, two nuns, and a priest. Right? That's a conspiracy. In my day in the cops and robbers business, however, conspiracy was really conspiracy. I hope I don't offend anybody, but I'll give you our working definition of it. Back in my day, a conspiracy was 13 guys whose last names end with a vowel plus a stool pigeon. That's a conspiracy. We will assume that you're a defense lawyer in a great conspiracy case, the Rosenberg conspiracy case, right? Doesn't fit the definition, but just the exception that proves the rule. Conspiracy to steal the secret of the atom bomb and send it behind the Kremlin walls, right? This actually was one of the overt acts charged in that Rosenberg indictment, that on a certain day, one of the conspirators registered at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Now, you know that hotel in New York City. It's about three times the size of this hotel. And the prosecutor calls a witness. Who are you, sir? This is direct examination. I'm the desk clerk at the Waldorf Astoria. Were you on duty on January 1st, 1949? Yes. And now we start to play the game, right? What does the prosecutor say? He says, Mr. Witness, look around this courtroom and just tell us, yes or no, whether you see in court somebody you registered on that day. And now how do we play it? You know, first the witness takes off his glasses. He spends 30 seconds polishing them up. The tension builds to the point where the jury is no longer continent. Now the witness starts. He gets his glasses cleaned off, and where does he begin? He begins with the judge, right? No. Then he starts with the people in the jury box. He runs right down the line, all 12 of them, saying no. And now he starts working across those chairs in the well of the court. Now, I can only describe the federal court where I used to practice. There was a special chair, and on that chair there was a big sign. And on that sign it said, this is where the defendant sits. Make no mistake about it. And finally, the witness gets up to that chair and he says, ah! That's the one I registered on that day. And the prosecutor sits down and he has proved that devastating overt act. You're the defense lawyer. Cross-examine. Now, we'll just use what we've already done. You're going to impeach by asking him when he last went to church? Of course not. You're going to impeach by asking him whether he really saw the person register? No. He's not lying. But why? How can he remember? Right? And so how might we cross-examine? Waldorf Astoria is a big hotel, isn't it? Yes. How long had you been a desk clerk before this day in question? 9 years. How many days a week do you work? 5. How many weeks a year? 48. About how many people a day do you register? About 250. So in the 9 years before this day, by my arithmetic, you had registered 1,212,917 people, correct? Correct. And have you been working since then? Yes. Right up until today? Yes. So in the time since, you've registered another 2,412,813, correct? Correct. And now what do you do? Stop! Sit down! And what will you argue in summation? He can't possibly remember one person out of 4 million. Will you stop? Will you sit down? No. Instead, you will ask the next question, and every one of you has asked that next question. Then how come, Mr. Big Shot, you can remember this one person out of 4 million? And every time you ask that question, you're going to get the answer, you know. Well, he walked up to me and he put a gun to my head. He said, if you don't register me, I'll kill you. So I remember. What's the fourth element of competence? Communication! Right. You don't use it very often. In my own career at the bar, such as it was, I remember using it only once. But when you can use it, it's devastating. Right? How? Well, you all remember. You're right in it. You're doing it every day. You're not retired to the groves of academia as I am. The other side calls a witness. You're going to have to cross-examine that witness. You know how you sit there in the courtroom? Every meter is on. Your tentacles are out. You're picking up the radar, the emanations, the impressions. You're existing for those few minutes or few hours at a degree of concentration and sensitivity unknown to practitioners in other branches of the profession and unknown to other professions. Everything is reading. And that witness is called up by the people on the other side. And at once you size up the witness. It's got the intelligence of an earthworm, right? The morals of a scorpion. And now we're going to listen to the direct examination. And he talks, and suddenly in the middle of his testimony, on direct examination, there comes the word that clinks. He says, anti-disestablishmentarianism. Now, cross-examination, using that fourth pigeonhole, right? Communication. Mr. Witness, you used the word anti-disestablishmentarianism. Yeah. What does it mean? I don't know. Here's a yellow pad. Write it down. I can't. You mean you don't know how to spell it? No. When's the first time in your life you ever heard that word? When the district attorney told me what to say on the witness stand. Now do you know what to do? Yeah, now you'll know. Stop. Sit down. And what will you argue in summation? That's no witness. That's a human tape recorder. Just repeating what the district attorney programmed into him before this trial started. They have got the first four modes of impeachment. Really quite easy. I guess I'm not equipped with an eraser, but it doesn't matter. Now let's turn to the middle group of four. Why do I segregate them? The first four are related in the fashion that you see. They involve the reverse use of the elements of competence. This middle group of four are also related in a way that I will make clear to you in just a few moments. But they're entirely different from the first four. This middle group of four share certain characteristics. And it's because of these shared characteristics that we deal with them separately. I think it will be efficient, considering the restrictions of time, to pull out of this middle group of four two issues which will arise whenever you seek to impeach using one or another of that middle group of four. Instead of talking about it four different times with respect to each one of the pigeonholes, let's pull them out, talk about them in general, and then we can save time and just address them in passing as we run through the four pigeonholes. Right? Two issues which will arise whenever you seek to impeach a witness by making use of that middle group of four. First, it is a characteristic of this middle group of four that you impeach the witness by asking a question which has nothing directly to do with the subject matter of the testimony given on direct examination. They've all done it, and it ties right into one aspect of the art of cross-examination, which we'll be talking about later on in the morning. You never want the witness to repeat on cross-examination what he said on direct, right? You all know that. So, the witness has testified on direct examination that the traffic light was green. And this is a case about the traffic light. Who had the light? That's it. He says the light was green. Now we're going to impeach, and I'm just going to make up a question. Never mind whether it's proper or not, I just do it so that it's easy to understand and remember. We're going to impeach him by asking this question. Sir, is it not a fact that you beat your wife last night. Assume that that's proper impeachment. Do you see the phenomenon we're working with? The case is about the color of the traffic light. On direct examination, the witness told us what he remembers the traffic light to have been. We are now impeaching by asking about beating your wife. That doesn't have anything directly to do with this case or with what the witness has said on direct examination. Assume, for the sake of discussion, that the question is proper because it fits one of this middle group of four modes of impeachment. If the witness says, yes, I did it, drop it. Go to something else. And then you'll argue in summation what wife beating tells you about the credibility of the witness. But suppose the witness denies it. He says, no, I did not beat my wife. There's the issue. What happens when, using one or another of this middle group of four modes of impeachment, when a witness denies the impeaching information? He says no to the impeaching question. You see it? Now, the problem, of course, is this. Will we be permitted, as part of our case, to introduce evidence tending to show that the denial was false? That really a truthful answer would have been yes. Or, on the contrary, are we restricted simply to asking the question? And then if he says no, that's it. We've got to take his answer. See the problem? Now, why is it that you can argue it both ways? Well, for the former, that we can introduce that other evidence. You'd say, well, it bears upon credibility. In most trials, that's the ballgame. That's what the jury has to decide. So it's worth spending the time listening to this other evidence that tends to show that the denial of the impeaching information was false. The contrary argument is what? For God's sakes, this is a trial about a traffic light, not about wife beating. We're not going to spend time listening to that other evidence. That issue is the famous collateral, non-collateral issue, about which lawyers and judges have been confused for generations. Note that the term collateral or not collateral does not apply to the issue of the propriety of the impeaching question. The propriety of the impeaching question is determined by reference to my nine pigeonholes. In a manner of speaking, maybe I should have said this at the start, if there is an objection raised to a question asked in connection with impeachment, this is how to handle it in your mind. You've got the nine pigeonholes. Take that question and run it along the pigeonholes. If it fits one of the pigeonholes, it's proper, insofar as the law of evidence is concerned. If it does not fit one of the pigeonholes, it is improper. That's what I meant right at the start when I said that these nine pigeonholes are exhaustive. They represent everything that the law of evidence permits you to do. Did you beat your wife last night is the impeaching question. Run it along. It may well fit that third pigeonhole of the middle group of four. We'll be coming to it in 5 minutes. If it fits the pigeonhole, it is a proper question. The witness says, no, I did not beat my wife. Well, Your Honor, I want to call the next door neighbor who will testify that he heard the wife beating going on last night. That's the collateral, not collateral issue. If we will be permitted to call the next door neighbor, we say it's not collateral. It is not collateral to prove that the denial of the impeaching question was false. But if it is collateral, it means we can ask the question because it fits into one of the pigeonholes. But if the witness says no, we're stuck with the answer. We may not go beyond it. We may not call those other witnesses to testify that really he did beat his wife. Is it collateral? Is it not collateral? The answer differs depending upon the pigeonhole that you're using. That's one of the utilities of this pigeonhole gimmick. Who can remember all these miscellaneous rules? But when you peg them to these pigeonholes, it falls into place. And so as we run through them, I will tell you, at the end of our brief discussion of each one of the pigeonholes, whether it's collateral or not collateral. And you get the idea. If it's collateral, you can ask the question. But if the witness says no, that's an end. If it's not collateral, you can ask the question. If he says no, you can call other witnesses as part of your case who testify in essence that the denial of the impeaching question was false. That's the first general issue. Collateral, not collateral. Now the second general issue. You're using one of these modes of impeachment. The witness on direct examination has testified that the traffic light was green. Now we stand up to impeach. Mr. Witness, is it not a fact that you commit sodomy every night with a parrot? Now what? Well, first they peel the jurors off the back wall. And now, His Honor, Goes like that. And you've all had this happen to you. You trot up to the sidebar, and there is His Honor. And he looks at you and he says, "What the fuck are you doing?" And what is your response? Well, when you were younger, you might simply bat your baby blue eyes at the judge and say, "Well, Your Honor, I'm just testing credibility." Is that a sufficient answer? Well, if it were a sufficient answer, there is no limit on your power to poison the jury, except the extent to which you have a diseased imagination. You can make up anything, right? So long as it fits one of the pigeonholes. And what the hell do you care what the answer is? Once the jury hears the question, so then it must be that that's an insufficient answer. It must be that there is a limit. Granted, the question is technically proper because it fits one of these categories. There's got to be an outer limit on your power to poison the jury by asking hair-raising questions of that kind. And of course, there is an outer limit. It's a very simple one, but it must never be forgotten. There must be a good faith basis beneath the question. You must have a good faith basis for asking that question. What is a good faith basis? What does it take to add up to a good faith basis? Who knows? That will vary with the circumstances, and the circumstances are infinite, of course. But a good faith basis is what is required. So when the judge calls you up after you ask that question about the parrot, and he says, "Why, you know, what are you doing?" Your response should be, "Your Honor, it fits the third category, and indeed it does in most states, and I have a good faith basis for asking the question." And the judge might well then ask for a representation as to what your good faith basis is. And you'll know how to answer that. "Well, Judge, here's the parrot. Ask him." It's a crucial moment. Call that coitus interruptus. Whether that is in fact a good faith basis is a law school-y question. We're not going to discuss that here. I guess it all depends upon the degree to which the parrot is articulate, but let's not worry about it. So, we've got the collateral, not collateral issue, and the good faith basis requirement. And now let's zip through that middle group of four. There's no special magic to the order in which I discuss them. It's just the order in which I am accustomed to discussing them. The first category, or pigeonhole, the label, the name, tells you virtually everything that you need to know. Bias, prejudice, interest, corruption. That's not four pigeonholes, that's just one, the first one. Bias, prejudice, interest, corruption. What is bias? An irrational predisposition in favor. What is prejudice? An irrational predisposition against. Interest, stake in the outcome. Corruption, bribery. That's it. And if you want to spread that out into a sentence, it would be this: you may impeach in every jurisdiction in the land. No limitations on this anywhere. By showing that the witness is biased, prejudiced, interested, or corrupt. You have an absolute right to do that. And as a matter of fact, if a judge curtails cross-examination involving that particular mode of impeachment, there is probably going to be a reversal on appeal. It can be done very delicately. And almost all of you perhaps have done it. You know that when you've got the ammunition, this is dynamite with the jury. It is very potent indeed. The witness has testified in support of an alibi defense for the defendant in a criminal case. You are the prosecutor. The witness is an elderly lady. She has testified that the defendant was with her in the movies at the time the bank was robbed. All right, you stand up. We assume a good faith basis, of course, and you simply say, "Now, madam, you're the defendant's mother, aren't you?" "Well, yes, I am." "What do you do now?" "Stop. Sit down. Not one question more is necessary. Even a beginner would recognize it." Why? No jury is going to believe that woman's testimony. It's the defendant's mother. But now, put the right label on it. What have you done? You've used the first pigeonhole of this middle group of four. It's bias or interest. They overlap, of course. Irrational predisposition in favor of her son, the emotional stake in the outcome. Prejudice. You represent a black person. You're cross-examining a witness who has testified against him. Good faith basis, of course. "Sir, you are a life member of the Ku Klux Klan, are you not?" "Yes." "Boom. Sit down. You've done it." Prejudice. Corruption. "Sir, you've been bribed to give your testimony in this case, haven't you?" "There better be a good faith basis for that one." Okay.
And assuming that there is, you understand you've won the case once you ask that question. Or to put it in more humdrum terms, some of you like to cross-examine or impeach a doctor, you know, the testifying doctor in a personal injury case. Doctor, what are you getting paid for your testimony here? And then you know the answer. I'm not getting paid for my testimony. I'm getting paid for my time. And then you fence around, and ultimately it comes out. And if it's a really big sum, jurors tend to be a little bit disturbed. At least in my experience, they do. And there you have it, with just one passing reference to collateral, not collateral. How about it? You're his mother, aren't you? No, I'm not. You're a life member of the Ku Klux Klan, aren't you? No, I'm not. You've been bribed to give your testimony. No, I haven't. Will you be permitted to call other witnesses who will testify that, yes, she is his mother? Yes, he is a life member of the Ku Klux Klan. Yes, he has been bribed. And the answer is yes. It is not collateral. Why? Because the law in its infinite wisdom recognizes that the impeaching value of questions that fit into that first pigeonhole of the middle group of four is very high. The impeaching value is high, the impact on the jury is enormous. Hence, we will waste time, not waste time really, but devote time, listening to those other witnesses, not collateral. And that's why you have to know which pigeonhole you're in. Next pigeonhole. Impeachment by conviction, showing that the witness has been convicted of a crime. Had we unlimited time, we could spend 2 hours talking about this because it's probably the single most controversial issue in the law of evidence these years. In general, or in its pristine or original form, you may impeach any witness in any kind of case by showing that the witness has been convicted of a crime. Convicted means convicted. Guilty plea or found guilty after trial. It doesn't mean indictment, it doesn't mean arrest. And crime means crime, however defined in that jurisdiction. The reason this has become controversial is that with respect to a certain kind of witness, the possibility of this type of impeachment raises profound problems. What kind of witness? Well, at least a third or a half of you do criminal work, you know. The special kind of witness represented by the defendant in a criminal case. Need he take the stand? No. Privilege against self-incrimination. Guards against that. May he take the stand? Yes. Whose option is it? The defendant's. And in its original form, what did the law have to say? Once he takes the stand, nobody can make him. But once he decides to take the stand, he becomes a witness like any other. His credibility is an issue like any other. How may he be impeached? Let's just review. Assume you can do everything and you want to do everything. When's the last time you went to church? Boom. Did you see it? No. You remember it? No. You know what you're talking about? No. You're the defendant in this case, aren't you? That's interest. And now, the one we're talking about. The fact is, Mr. Witness, you've been in trouble before, haven't you? Well, now that you mention it, yes. You were convicted last year of statutory rape, right? Well, yeah. And the year before that of selling heroin to junior high school students, right? Yeah. And the year before that of kidnapping, huh? Yeah. And the year before that of bank robbery, yeah. And out it comes. And what's happening all the time? Well, you know what's happening. Let me summarize it in my best law school professor manner. Ladies and gentlemen, what is the genius of Anglo-Saxon criminal law? The genius of Anglo-Saxon criminal law is that the defendant will have his guilt or innocence determined solely on the basis of the evidence tending to show that he did or did not do the thing charged in this indictment, and nothing else. The indictment says he robbed a bank. The only evidence the jury may consider is the evidence that shows that he did or did not rob the bank. Why he didn't cry at his mother's funeral doesn't count. That he's been a bad boy all these years in the past doesn't count. The only thing that counts is the evidence that shows that he robbed the bank or did not rob the bank. That's the genius of Anglo-Saxon criminal law. But now he takes the stand. The jury hears about these convictions. What will the judge say to the jury? Well, you know, the judge will say to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard about these hair-raising convictions. I nearly fell out of my chair when I heard them myself. Now! I know that as good citizens, you probably reacted in the same way, but you must put that reaction to one side. Those convictions are before you only to the extent that they may help you assess the credibility of the defendant on the witness stand. You may not consider those convictions as tending to show that he deserves to be convicted. Why not? Because that would offend the genius of Anglo-Saxon criminal justice. You see that it does. The only question is, what's the evidence to show that he robbed this bank? Not that he's led a bad life with 5 prior serious convictions. The judge will tell the jury that. He can tell it to them until he's blue in the face. Do they understand what he's talking about? No. Now, it's another one of the pious fictions that we just have to pretend to believe in order to get our work done. The jury sits there and listen, and they listen. Yeah, they do listen. They do their best to listen, I know. And they get in the jury room, and what do they say? Did you hear those convictions? Gonna lock that guy up and throw away the key to protect the rest of us. You know what? If I were on the jury, I'd think the same way. And if you were on the jury, you'd think the same way. But it does offend the genius of Anglo-Saxon criminal justice, so we've got to do something about it. Luckily, we're never on juries. Now, what do? This is why this subject has become so controversial. Lawyers, judges, legislators over the last 10 or 15 years have been very concerned with giving the defendant a fair trial. And if the convictions are going to come out, he will not have a fair trial. I put it as bluntly as that. If by fair trial we mean a trial in accordance with the traditional notions of Anglo-Saxon criminal justice, what do? Well, as you know, the law has been evolving in a number of directions. This is a subject that is not completed by any means. We're still experimenting with it. In some jurisdictions, there has been a limitation on the type of conviction that can be used. In other jurisdictions, there has been a time limitation. If it's a recent conviction, you can use it. If it's not a recent conviction, you cannot use it. Some of you may be familiar with the Luck case in the District of Columbia, decided by the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, holding, just a sentence or two, that before trial, the defendant is entitled to have a hearing. At that hearing, the defendant takes the stand and gives his testimony. The district attorney shows the judge what the criminal record is, and the judge exercises a discretion, conviction by conviction. This one may be used, this one may not be used. This one has no real bearing on credibility, it will simply prejudice the jury. This one, a perjury conviction 2 years ago, does have a bearing on credibility, so it may be used, so on down the line. That Luck doctrine, which began simply as a rule for the federal courts, obviously the federal courts, for the courts in the District of Columbia, has come to be very influential. Just within the last year, it has been picked up in my home state of New York. The New York Court of Appeals adopted the Luck doctrine for New York. It has been picked up by the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. It has been picked up by a number of other state courts. It appears in somewhat modified form, together with other kinds of restrictions, in the federal evidence rules. It's Rule 609, as you know. It's a kind of complicated rule. You'll have to look at it for yourself if you do work in the federal courts. But there are various ways in which the draftsmen of the federal rules and Congress thought it wise to limit the right of a prosecutor to impeach a defendant with convictions. And the nature of those limitations are right there in Rule 609. And finally, one last case or development to mention to you. For those of you who do practice in the criminal field, this is a case you should be aware of, though to my astonishment, it is obscure. It has not been widely noted. 3-4 years ago, the Supreme Court of Hawaii squarely held that the use of convictions to impeach a defendant who takes the stand in his own behalf violates due process. It is not permitted in a criminal court in Hawaii. Now, it's a due process case, but of course it applies only to the courts of Hawaii. Still, it's a Supreme Court of a sister state. It has a certain precedential value, and it seems to me that every defense lawyer should have it as part of his armory and pull it out when the occasion arises. That case is State against Santiago, 492 Pacific 2nd, 657, Hawaii, 1971. That's really all we can do with impeachment by conviction. Let's move to the third mode of impeachment. This is called prior bad acts. Oh, I'm sorry, the collateral, not collateral issue. It's very easy. It will, first of all, it will never arise as a practical matter. When you ask a witness, have you been convicted, the witness damn well knows that you've got the record of conviction. There's no point in denying it, so he won't deny it. But in theory, if the witness denies the conviction, it is not collateral. You may prove the conviction by other evidence, but you will be limited in your mode of proof to the most efficient evidence available. And you know what that efficient evidence is? The certified or exemplified judgment of conviction. Do it by the record. In theory, you could do it in other ways. Call the foreman of the jury that found him guilty. Call the judge. Call the clerk of the court. We will not spend the time on that. You've got to do it by the judgment of conviction. Now, the third, prior bad acts. Not a conviction, but some prior act by the witness of an immoral, criminal, or vicious nature. Not every jurisdiction permits this mode of impeachment, but a majority do. For example, the witness has testified on direct examination that the traffic light was green. Mr. Witness, did you beat your wife last night? Or do you commit sodomy with a parent? Or whatever it may be. These acts did not crystallize in a conviction, but they're of an immoral, criminal, or vicious nature, and in a majority of the courts, you will be permitted to question the witness about it, on the theory that it does have a bearing upon credibility. In those jurisdictions which allow it, it is collateral, meaning you may ask the question, but if the witness denies it, you've got to take the answer. You will not be permitted to call other witnesses to say, yes, he did beat his wife, or whatever it may be. The reasoning there is that while the question has enough of a relationship to credibility to render the question permissible, the relationship to credibility is so slight that we will not spend the time listening to this independent evidence to show that the denial was false. Again, because of the pressures of time, let's move on. Number four. Perhaps the most commonly used mode of impeachment, and perhaps the simplest. Nobody in this audience is confused about it, but trial lawyers whom I used to see trying cases back home in New York City generally knew that there was such a mode of impeachment, but they didn't have at their fingertips the ability to use this mode of impeachment crisply and elegantly, and that's what you want, of course. What is this mode of impeachment? Prior inconsistent statement. You know how common it is. Use it three times a day in your own practice. The witness says on direct examination that the light was green. We are now going to put before the jury a prior statement by the witness in which he says that the light was red. What's the impeaching value of it? Well, it's obvious. The witness talks out of both sides of his mouth, talks with a forked tongue, therefore he's not worth believing. Says one thing today, another thing back then. In theory, that's all there is to say about this mode of impeachment. It's very common, it can be very potent. Why is it that there's such confusion, such lack of elegance in using it? Because in most jurisdictions, there is a preliminary requirement which must be met before you can impeach with a prior inconsistent statement. And the tag name for that preliminary requirement is what? You all recall your early days at the bar. You set out to impeach a witness with a prior inconsistent statement. The lawyer on the other side jumped up and said, I object. No foundation. The judge said, objection sustained. Well, what are they talking about? Right? If you had the guts, you'd say to the judge, judge, help me. Right? If you really...